Welcome back, Questions Madison 2021. 21, yes, this is the first podcast of 2021, but it is still the same old podcast, and I'm still the same old Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in when I'm getting on. We're going to break down what I'm talking about, and this podcast is going to be some listener email. I'm going to summarize what they said, and then I'm going to give my response. I've already given my response to them as an individual, but I think the whole Questioning Medicine family as a whole should listen to it. Over the next month or so, every year at the beginning of the year, I create three different lectures. One is the top 10 articles for primary care providers, one is the top 10 articles for hospitalists, and one is the top 10 guideline updates from the previous year. Those are three lectures I put together, and then I give them at different conferences and at different meetings over the year. But you as a Questioning Medicine listener are going to get some of those updates for absolutely free, 50-free. But if you have any grand rounds or some sort of a CME lecture or some sort, you just need a lecturer and you think, oh, you know what? I would like to have that guy, Andrew Belt from sunny St. Petersburg, Florida, zoom in and tell me about the top 10 articles for whatever the situation may be. Let me know, Andrew Belt, B-U-E-L-T at gmail.com. And then I think with that, we can kick the show off. I think with that, we can start this program. I think with that, it is so good to be back. All right, welcome back, Angel Bill, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? One of the first listener emails was from Dr. Sprouse, and it had to do with vitamin D. Yes, vitamin D. I was hoping that I did not have to talk about vitamin D in 2021, but here we are, so let's get into it. His email said, endocrinology is saying that vitamin D below 30 leads to secondary hyperparathyroidism due to calcium absorption deficiency, and downstream consequences of that condition leads to poor bone health. He agreed all other outcomes don't have good evidence. I think 30 is the recommendation from the Society of Endocrinology. Well, let's break this down in my response. And I will say that this endocrinologist, whoever that endocrinologist is potentially right, but he's also potentially wrong. He's right in the fact that he says all other outcomes don't have good evidence. He is spot on. All other outcomes don't have good evidence, which is weird that he thinks that his outcome does have good evidence, because if you have something that doesn't have good evidence for anything and it's been tested in almost everything, it would be very odd that it would all of a sudden work for your one particular outcome. I mean, that's just a little bit of bias if you get what I'm saying here. But here's my response. And just to be clear, this endocrinologist is right, but completely wrong. Yes, it may, and the keyword is may, because it's not a universal truth. It may cause secondary hyperparathyroidism. However, as I am sure you, Dr. Sprouse, has already thought about, this is just a lab value. We don't care about lab values. We care about patients. We treat patients, not lab values. So realistically, who cares? They, the endocrinologist, will say, well, we care because it leads to broken bones and fractures. And then when that happens, Dr. Sprouse, you should say, based on what data? Because in a trial titled Effects of Supplemental Vitamin D on Bone Health Outcomes in Women and Men in the Vitamin D and Omega-3 Vital Trial, which was published January 2020, in this trial of almost 700 women who underwent bone mineral density testing at baseline and 2 years later, there was no difference between vitamin D and placebo. Absolutely no difference. And then the endocrinologist is going to say, yes, there was no difference. Yes, there was no difference because individuals already had high baseline vitamin Ds. That's going to be the argument you're going to hear. And when you hear that argument, you should respond with, wait a second. So you think that there's something magical that happens at the cutoff of 30 that makes it so these patients now magically benefit from vitamin D? 31, no benefit. 30, boom, benefit. I mean, come on, people. And they will say this. Yes, this is correct. There is something magical about 30. There's a cutoff of 30 that I know you can't wrap your mind around because you're not a specialist like we are in endocrinology. But yeah, trust us, it's 30. And we know because our society guidelines say so. And to that, I would say that you should say, well, what about this article in the BMJ last year, 2020, titled, Your Results May Vary, The Imprecision of Medical Measurements. And in this article, they talk about the analytical and biological variance of vitamin D, and that the baseline of any vitamin D test is about 50% confidence interval, which basically means that you need to see a 50% change to even say that there is a real difference. And a lab value of 30 could actually mean that the real number falls anywhere from, I don't know, 18 to 42, because the lab values are just point estimates. But in all actuality, there are 95% confidence intervals that surround each lab value or point estimate. Thus, this shouldn't be, there is no magical number. The magical number, if you really wanted to turn it down, shouldn't be 30. The magical number should be then 41 or 42, because that then means that the person is still within the confidence interval of 30 or less than 30 that you think you, Endocrinology Society, think is so special and so fancy. And to this, the endocrinologist will probably say, I have no idea what you are talking about. All lab values are 100% accurate. The reason they're going to say this is because this concept is really hard for most people to understand or grasp. When we get a lab value or a sheet of labs back from the lab, we believe as physicians that this is gold. This is it. This must mean that the actual vitamin D level is exactly what we're looking at on this piece of paper that we're granted, put in our hands by the nurse or whoever or the computer. But it's not. There are confidence intervals around it. You could take blood from my left arm and blood from my right arm and send them off to the lab, and you're likely going to get different lab values that come back, different point estimates of the lab value that come back, because it is just a point estimate with a 95% confidence interval surrounding it. This is the same thing with LDL. It's the same thing with so many of the tests that we order. But once they say this, you, Dr. Sprouse, can turn to them and say, well, that is really interesting, because in this study titled Effect of High-Dose Vitamin D Supplementation on Volumetric Bone Density and Bone Strength, a randomized clinical trial from August 2019 in JAMA, they found those individuals with baseline enrollment vitamin D levels of 30 actually had worse volumetric bone density when taking higher levels of vitamin D. Yes, the higher the vitamin D supplementation, the worse your bone density was. They will likely say something like, yes, Dr. Sprouse, you are completely correct, but that did not have a true placebo group, and we, the Society of Endocrinology, fail to observe the rule of dose measurement. Let's basically cover what the rule of dose measurement means. It's usually used in observational studies, but it means that the more you give of a drug, the more you can expect to see the benefit, the more you can expect to see what is happening. It's not a linear curve. It's not that if you give 5 milligrams of lisinopril, then 20 milligrams of lisinopril gives you quadruple the amount. That's not how it works. But if you expect that vitamin D works for bone density, if that's what you think, then you should see an improvement at low doses. And as you give more doses of vitamin D, you should see an improvement in bone density. But in this study, they saw a little bit of a gain, and then the higher doses of vitamin D gave you less growth of bone density. That doesn't fit the rule of dose measurement. It doesn't work. You can't do it that way. That's not how it works. But let's go ahead and assume that the endocrinologist is not going to understand dose measurement, the rules of dose measurement. Let's go ahead and assume that the endocrinologist is not going to understand that it's a point estimate with confidence intervals around a lab value. It's not a precise number. So let's go ahead and assume all that. And we can see that the endocrinologist, the Society of Endocrinology, is really stuck on this magical cutoff of 30, even though the lab measurement is variable. And they don't believe in dose response measurements or the dose curve. But what about this article? What about this article titled Vitamin D Supplementation in Elderly Black Women Does Not Prevent Bone Loss, a randomized, yes, randomized control trial from June 2018 that took 260 women with vitamin D levels between 8 and 26, yes, 8 and 26, which is certainly less than 30, and randomized them to vitamin D levels achieved above 30, which ended up being about 3,500 international units a day. Yes, over 3,000 international units of vitamin D a day in order to get their baseline vitamin D levels above 30. And as they followed the patients up, they followed them for 3 years, they found there was no difference. There was no difference in bone density between the placebo group and the vitamin D group. Woo! Now, surely the endocrinologist will look at you and say, Dr. Sprouse, that is only one study. And you can't only look at one study. That's not what you can do. And then you, Dr. Sprouse, should turn to them and say, oh, well, what about this meta-analysis and systematic review in Lancet Endocrinology titled Effects of Vitamin D Supplementation on Musculoskeletal Health, a Systematic Review, Meta-Analysis, and Trial Sequential Analysis that looked at 81 randomized controlled trials and over 53,000 people and found, and I quote, our findings suggest that vitamin D supplementation does not prevent fractures or falls or have clinically meaningful effect on bone mineral density. There were no differences between the effect of higher and lower doses of vitamin D. There is little justification to use vitamin D supplementation to maintain or improve musculoskeletal health. This conclusion should be reflected in clinical guidelines. End quote. Oh, we could only wish. We could only wish. And once you drop that little nugget, drop that little pearl in their lap, I am sure the endocrinologist will turn to you and say, yes, but you see, it is those individuals with vitamin D's less than 30 that really benefit, because they just can't wrap their mind around that they've been practicing wrong medicine for this long, that the evidence doesn't support what they're doing. And with that, you can turn with a real big smile and say, luckily, this paper, this meta-analysis systematic review, even did a secondary analysis looking at those individuals with vitamin D levels greater than 30 and less than 30 and found, and I quote, no consistent evidence of different effects in subgroup analysis based upon potentially influential baseline variabilities, including baseline vitamin D levels or study design characteristics, nor of different effects in trials of high-dose vitamin D or low-dose vitamin D trials to achieve vitamin D concentration. Said differently, it didn't matter. It didn't matter what the number was. It didn't matter how much you gave. It didn't matter how much you gave to make the number become. It did not matter. And the Society of Endocrinology will probably continue to say, we always treat under a vitamin D of 30. I will tell you, as a personal note, I have been fighting the vitamin D fight now for what seems like 7, 8, really since the beginning of this podcast. And before that, even before I started the podcast, I was fighting this fight. And now, the more and more I have and more I do, I have realized it is something that is a quote attributed to Upton Sinclair when he said, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. Sadly, as I have said on this podcast before, the belief of vitamin D is far greater than the evidence. What I have learned is adult education can only be desired, it cannot be taught. You can go to the best residency program in the entire world, but when you get out on your own, you either keep reading, keep questioning, or you just follow what someone else tells you like a blind dog. You take the guidelines and you say, well, this is what the guidelines say, so this is what I'm going to do. You stop reading the trials completely of yourself. And there is nothing wrong with either style. There's nothing wrong with following guidelines, even when the guidelines are wrong. I mean, it's okay. A lot of other people do it. It's not how I prefer to practice medicine, but there's nothing wrong with it. Either style is okay, because in the morning, both providers, whether they follow guidelines or follow the actual evidence, wake up wanting what's best for the patient. And I will tell you, Dr. Sprouse, on a personal note to you, usually, no matter how hard you try, I have found You can never, and I mean never, make a blind dog see where they're going. Best of luck. And with that, let's move on to another listener question. Now, the next listener question is a combination of two questions or two conversations I've had back and forth with Dr. Dodge and Dr. Lair, and I appreciate both of you for listening. I appreciate all of you for listening. And if you're learning anything from this, I always ask that you send this podcast or any podcast on to one other individual to help them learn, to help them spread the questioning medicine ways, and subscribe if you haven't already. But for both Dr. Dodge and Dr. Lair, they have asked me variable questions about the COVID-19 vaccine and what I think about it. Am I going to get it? And obviously, the problem is we don't have long-term data on this vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine, or even this type of vaccine. This is the first of its kind. Those individuals or providers, and I've heard them, people say it, this vaccine is super safe. They are lying to you. They are, or at least they're not telling you the whole truth. It is super safe for now, but we don't have long-term data on it. So you can't say it's super safe until you have long-term data on something. That's just how it works. And we wouldn't do this with any other drug. I promise you, there is no other drug that comes to market that we give to our patients and we say, don't worry, this drug is super safe. No, we say it's a new drug. It seems really safe. It's past the initial trials. But we're honest and we say, we don't really know what the long-term effects are yet, especially if it's a lifelong drug like a blood pressure drug or a statin or something like that. Luckily for me, I have already had COVID-19 and so has the better brain. But then people say, well, wait a sec, you had COVID-19, but aren't you concerned about your immunity? Did you go get your titers checked? I mean, aren't you concerned that your IgG titers go away after 6 to 8 months and maybe they're going to go away after the shot and we need to get another vaccine over and over and over and over again? When doctors say this, I shake my head. It is such simplistic thinking. It's almost like these doctors went to residency training with OBGYN and forgot how to use their brain. I'm sorry, I promise that is one of the few or last times in 2021 I will diss on the College of Obstetrics and Gynecology for not being able to critically think about things, unless, of course, they come out with a new guideline, in which case all bets are completely off. But I refuse to believe, if I logically think about it, that this just magically goes away, that your body is so dumb that you get a virus, it makes antibodies, and then all of a sudden, at the stroke of midnight, 6 to 8 months later, boom, poof, all memory cells, all T cells, B cells, everything is completely gone. You're just like a brand new spring chicken, freshly hatched. You don't know squat. This is completely illogical. The body is not that dumb. I mean, this is not Cinderella and the glass titers. It's not like at the stroke of midnight, boom, titers gone. You don't have any more. You are now fresh to get COVID-19 once again. And as far as I'm aware, there's actually been no complete, really documented cases of repeat infections. Yeah, sure, there are some people that had COVID-19 and then they test positive a month later and 2 months later and 3 months later and they continue to test positive. I had one patient in the hospital, for example, that tested positive 5 months later. But he never didn't test positive. He continued to test positive. I have yet to really see any true case reports of someone getting it again. And if they did get it again, it wasn't severe. It wasn't severe at all. It was like, I got a little ribbit in my throat when I wake up in the morning. It wasn't a big deal. Why is that? Likely because they had a memory response to it. The body said, oh, we've seen this before. No worries. We'll knock this out. You probably won't even know about it. One of the things I find really interesting when I was doing a deep dive on the flu vaccine a couple years ago was that when you look at the flu vaccine, giving one flu vaccine to an elderly individual is not beneficial. It's true. You look it up. Go to Cochrane. Giving the flu vaccine to an elderly individual is not beneficial in that individual year. But, if this elderly individual had the flu shot every year for 10, 20, 30 years, the longer that they had received the flu shot every single year, then the flu shot was beneficial. Let's think to ourselves, how could this be? How is it possible that getting the flu shot just a one-time isolated event is not beneficial, but getting the flu shot every single year seems to be beneficial? What I'm about to say is completely expert opinion. I have no actual randomized controlled data to back up what I'm going to say, and that is that over time, you develop memory cells to all the vaccines you receive. Over time, over 30, 40 years, you have these stored memory cells that say, oh, look at this. I do remember this. I do remember this. I do remember this. So then even if we guess, and I'm putting guess in air quotes so you can't see, even if we guess the flu vaccine completely wrong, you don't have to worry about it because you have not only memory cells from this flu vaccine, but every other flu vaccine that you've received for the last 30 years. Your body is just like a heightened awareness. It's a fort. It's with a whole bunch of memory cells and T cells and B cells just hanging out like crazy, waiting to attack. And that brings me to the last article before I close this up. And then I'm going to close up this podcast. It is a title in the Journal of Science. I am sure you all read the Journal of Science titled Immunological Memory to SARS-CoV-2 Assessed for Up to 8 Months After Infection. In this study, they analyzed the SARS memory cells in 250 samples from 190 COVID-19 cases, and they found that the spike-specific memory B cells were more abundant at 6 months than at 1 month post-symptom onset. They go on to say, and I quote, notably, memory B cells specific for the spike protein were detected in almost all COVID-19 cases with no apparent half-life at 5 to 8 months post-infection. Other studies of memory B cells are reporting similar findings. B cell memory to some other infections has been observed to be long-lived, including 60-plus years after a smallpox vaccine and 90-plus years after infection with influenza. So, I think that if you've had COVID-19, you likely don't really need the vaccine because you've already got immunity to COVID-19. I could be completely wrong. There's no real evidence on this either way. People that had COVID-19 were excluded from the trial. So you can't email me and say, Andrew, you're completely crazy. You definitely need to get it. Because if that's what you're saying, you're using expert opinion. And that expert opinion is your own opinion. Because we don't know. And it's okay to say we don't know. And we should be honest when we don't know. And with that, let's wrap this up like we've closed everyone before it. I ask of you, if you've learned anything during this podcast or any previous podcast, share this with one friend. I'm looking in 2021, let's double the listenership. Let's double the spread of questioning medicine together all as one. So with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every single one before it. Until next time, wait for the music. Keep the quest in questioning.